Good afternoon, and welcome to today's Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley's Voices of Reform program, brought to you from the new Camera 12 Theaters in downtown San Jose. My name is Scott Neese, and I will be your chair for today's program. It gives me great pleasure to welcome and introduce Joe Trippi, political analyst, consultant, and author of The Revolution Will Not Be Televised, Democracy, the Internet, and the Overthrow of Everything. Joe is a Bay Area native who is regarded as the man who reinvented campaigning. He started his political career in 1980 as part of Senator Edward M. Kennedy's presidential campaign and has worked with over 100 different mayoral, gubernatorial, Senate, and presidential candidates. Known for his revolutionary and innovative strategies, Joe has worked with presidential candidates Walter Mondale, Gary Hart, Richard Gephardt, and most recently served as the national campaign manager for Governor Howard Dean. With the Dean campaign, Joe helped re-engage American voters by pioneering the use of online technology. In a year, he organized what became the largest grassroots movement, where Dean supporters grew from 432 to over 640,000 people and raised more money than any Democrat in history, an astounding $50 million. He capitalized on small donor funding, $100 or less, and brought fundamental change to our electoral system. As a political analyst and commentator, Joe appears regularly on MSNBC and currently leads his multimedia consulting firm, Trippi & Associates. His new book, The Revolution Will Not Be Televised, is a captivating look into the future of politics and democracy and can be viewed as a real wake-up call to all voters, business executives, and government leaders. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Joe Trippi.
Thank you. Thank you for that introduction, and thank you for the invitation to speak here with the Commonwealth Club of Silicon Valley. I want to talk today about how the Internet is changing politics and how it is the most revolutionary, most powerful tool ever put in the hands of the American people, the people of California. What we're seeing is a sea change in the way politics will be conducted in the future. And the reason is politics, like most of our institutions, our political parties, our governmental institutions and corporations are all top-down institutions in which information is power. That's what we were all taught as we came up, that information was power. If information is power, and the Internet distributes information democratically to everyone out there who can receive it, who can have access to it, then the net is not delivering information anymore. It's delivering power to the bottom. And in a top-down society and top-down institutions, power aggregating at the bottom is a very disruptive thing. That's why the first time you saw this was Napster. It wasn't the Dean campaign. It was Napster, a bunch of folks at the bottom, young people at the bottom, wreaking havoc on a top-down recording industry, changing forever the way music would be distributed, and the recording industry lost power. It lost control over how music would be distributed, how people would consume it, all because of hundreds of thousands and turning millions of young people who decided they were going to change it and use the Internet to do it. The Dean campaign came along and was sort of the second ripple. It's the bottom rising up and realizing that it has the power to reform and change a political system that's busted and broken. And the Dean campaign, starting, as talked about, with 432 people, grew to 650,000, but what was more significant was the number of those people who didn't just use the Internet as an email device or to communicate, but actually used it to meet offline in their community, go door to door, use it as a way to organize. That had never happened before. That was really the big leap the big difference of 2003, and I think you're going to see more of that as we move forward in 2008. And what was going on is in this top-down system where money was king, too many Americans became convinced that they couldn't make a difference, that their $25 check, their 4 hours of walking in their neighborhood couldn't make a whit's bit of difference against all that money, against whether it was one party's pioneers and rangers or another party that's addicted to checks over $1 million. And that's what both major parties basically get their funding from today. How do you make a difference by yourself against that? And what happened was the internet makes that not true anymore, because by yourself, $25 doesn't matter. And you by yourself walking in your neighborhood, it's good for the neighborhood, it's good for your block, but in the grand scheme of things, it's not going to change a whole lot. What happened was people started waking up to the realization that if 100,000 of us do it, 200,000 of us do it, 1 million of us do it, 2 million of us do it, we can change anything. And what that is now raging around this country on both sides, which is a good thing. And I think it's really going to change and empower people to change the political system as we know it. But you're also seeing everything else is going to change too. You're already watching 60 Minutes with its report questioning President Bush's performance in the National Guard. People don't realize this, but 19 minutes into that segment on using those documents, 19 minutes into them, the first sign on the net, the first post on the net occurred saying these are fake and here's why, and went through a detailed questioning of the fonts, the spacing, everything. Within 4 hours, it was spreading across the internet on sites all over the net, and within 5 or 6 hours had leaped from the internet into mainstream media. And so you see an institution, a news institution, like Dan Rather and 60 Minutes, regarded for decades as one of the finest news organizations in this country, suddenly falling victim to the bottom-up ability of people to say, no, that's wrong, I'm going to say it's wrong, and I'm going to tell a lot of people, and it's going to percolate from the bottom. And just like the recording industry, the news industry is going to find out life's changed. So that's where this is all headed. And I believe it's inevitable that you cannot have this much information and this much power in terms of being able to communicate with each other and to become active with each other, to not have the American people finally say, we're going to change things. We finally have the tools that we need to change and reform the things that need to be reformed. And my best example of this is, I want to talk about, sort of give you an insight into why this is the case, is when Truman got on his train in the 40s and campaigned across this country, he would speak to audiences off the back of that train. 19 million Americans he spoke to from the back of that train. Think about what had to happen. Americans got up out of their homes, went down to the train station, waited for 2 hours for the train to come in, right? They're waiting there for 2 hours. They're talking about hog prices in Missouri. They're talking about, you know, Betty Sue down the way, about the schools, about what's going on in the community. And then they went home. 8 years later, Ike Eisenhower looked into a camera and talked to 19 million Americans in 10 million homes. Same people, same number of people, 1.9 persons per household. No one's going to the train station anymore. No one's having that. You're not. There's no social communication. America's becoming, in 8 years, that much more isolated. Today you have TiVo, right, where we aren't even going to watch the same thing at the same time anymore. You're not going to be able to walk into work and say, wow, did you see Friends last night? Because your coworker is going to say, no, I T-voted for Thursday, and don't tell me what happened. So television has actually made us more and more isolated, which means making reform and solving our problems tougher. And here comes this internet that, and let me explain that one to you. So yeah, they say it's really isolating. You're sitting there at that computer all by yourself. True. But as you're watching the event happen, the debate or whatever's going on that you're interested in, you're also IMing your friends, chatting with them, sending them emails, just like as close as you can get to what would have been happening at that train station with Truman, as we're ever going to get in terms of going back to a more communal discussion about what we need to do as a country and being able to connect with each other. So my view of this is, and I'll get this to a conclusion so we can have some questions here, but my view of what's happening is the American people finally have a way to connect with each other. A congressman from Hawaii, Neil Abercrombie, came up to me one day and said, you know what this really is? It's Americans having faith in strangers again. And I went, what? He goes, Joe, you understand, like, people are putting up on a website, I'm Joe Trippi, 8873, you know, 3rd Street. I want to hold a meeting to help Howard Dean or John Kerry or George Bush or whoever, and everybody's invited, but please sign here and tell me you're coming. And strangers, this guy's having 30, 40 strangers come to his or her house. They actually have the meeting. They actually decide what they're going to do. They welcome these folks in. The jewelry didn't disappear. You know, it's still there afterwards. This is like, you know, in a way, people having faith in strangers again, that we've done something, something's really changed, that there's a connectiveness with each other on the net that lets us trust each other again. And that's bizarre given what we would do in our own neighborhoods. So in many cases. So this is going on, and I think what's really happening here is if the establishment in terms of the two parties continue and the political establishment and government continues to squash reform, I think before there was no way for that, there was no place for that energy and impetus to go. You saw McCain come along and try to reform the Republican Party from within, and he was crushed. You saw Dean, in many ways, come along and try to reform the Democratic Party from within, and he was crushed. And there have been a lot of reform, Gary Hart in 84, and always crushed by these, by the institutions in the, in the party. And government does the same thing. It always tries to crush reform. And there really was no place to go. You got booted out of the party. How are you going to raise any money? How are you going to build an infrastructure? If you had a reform idea, where were you going to get the money unless you had some corporate sponsors or some other way to raise it to get initiative on the ballot or reform some other way? That's changed now. They cannot continue to squash that impulse. It's too strong in the American people. And now the American people have a place to go and find each other on the internet. And have proven, one guy proved, that you don't need any party infrastructure, you don't need any governmental infrastructure. You can raise more money than Bill Clinton did when he was president of the United States, which is what we did. And we didn't have the Lincoln bedroom to sell. And I mean that. I mean, some very good people have, because of this system, do some very strange things. And this, the only way the system is going to get changed, the only way you're going to have real reform, I believe, is because we finally have a tool that lets us all reach out together and find something that has not been talked about a lot in this nation for a long time, the common good and a common purpose to reform what needs to be reformed and make this country and our state a better place.
Thank you, Joe, for sharing your political insights with us. Now I would like to introduce Dr. Terry Christensen, political science professor at San Jose State University and co-author of Recall, California's Political Earthquake and California Government and Politics, who will be moderating our question and answer session.
Hi, Joe. Welcome back to San Jose. So the first question is, how did you get to where you are now?
Oh, that's a long... Well, first
we'll give
of
us
all,
the short version.
Well, I went to your class one day. That was my first mistake. And then I went and saw Louis Barozzi. That was my second mistake. He was my advisor at San Jose State. But no, I mean, there are a lot of people here in this city that really taught me a lot about how to organize. And I was an aeronautical engineering major at San Jose State. They not only taught me how to organize, but it inspired me to go try to do something about what needed to be changed. And I got active in city council politics here in San Jose. Worked my first campaign for a losing but wonderful candidate, Iola Williams, who would go on to be appointed to the city council. And somewhere along the way, I got a call from Washington, D.C., from Senator Kennedy's staff saying that they'd done some tests and realized I was crazy enough to get in my car and drive to Iowa, and I was, and I never came back. So, and the fact that I've done 7 presidential campaigns is something that proves I don't have to see a psychiatrist or anything. We don't have to have the diagnosis. I know what it is. But it was a lot of stuff that happened here, just going door to door, learning how to target. I mean, I was enthralled with politics because of a lot of people here who helped me learn about what I thought was something that could make a difference. And I always had this twin feeling that the technology actually changed people's lives sometimes a hell of a lot more than politics does. I mean, you know, it's like the microwave. I mean, that in a totally different way changed a bunch of people's lives. Although my favorite comment about the microwave is the American people are the only people who now cook a full meal that takes 3.5 hours normally in a machine that will do it in 3 minutes and still stamp their feet while the microwave's going because it's not being cooked fast enough. But so I thought technology and politics were a way to change things, and I somehow ended up knowing enough about both that I was able to help put the Dean campaign together.
You sort of left campaigns for a while, didn't you? Take a little break, and what was that about? Were you burned out? Were you finished?
Yeah, I felt a lot like I feel right now, actually. I had just after 88, I was with Gary Hart and Dick Gephardt that year, and just the whole Willie Horton ads that were run against Dukakis. I mean, the thing had, I'm not getting into even the partisanship and which side was right or wrong. I'm just saying it was become very ugly and very mean-spirited, and I just decided I'll go change the world a different way and get more involved in technology, which I'd always been involved in. So I went to work for high-tech companies building web communities and e-commerce communities, which I think was the best thing that ever happened to me because it meant I had been the guy nuts enough to do 7 presidential campaigns but also somehow knew enough about the web that I remember saying to myself in 95, if I'm ever crazy enough to do it one more time, president, I mean, I'm going to really try to see if there's a way to pull these two things together. And I didn't know how it was going to turn out, but and there's still a lot of people out there who don't necessarily think it turned out all that well. I think we made a big difference for the country, and I think hopefully we'll continue to make get other people to use those tools and make real change.
Clearly, it did make a big difference. There are people in our audience wondering how big a difference and how it's going to show up in actual voter turnout or registration of Democratic voters, for example. We know it got people organized for the Dean campaign, but Dean lost. We know it's raised a lot of money from small donors that hadn't previously been so engaged. Is there any evidence that it had an effect on voter turnout in the primaries? Do you think it'll have that effect in the general election? Is it engaging more young people in the electoral process?
Everywhere I go, I have not seen young people this energized in my career in politics over 30 years. I've never seen it this way. And they're as energized. Don't let anybody tell you that after Dean went away, they aren't interested or they're not involved. They are. It's amazing the different ways they've gotten involved. I think they're the great intangible in the election because they're not pullable, most of them. They're not findable. Many of them use cell phones, and pollsters have not really figured out how to do that, how to reach somebody randomly on a cell phone number. So I think they're out there. I think you're going to see an astonishing increase in their turnout this election. I also think that you're seeing this this ripple of energy. I mean, you see it when 34% more people watched the Kerry Bush debate in Miami than watched the first Bush Gore debate 4 years ago. So I mean, we're seeing what I think are signs that there's more energy out there than ever before, and I think the net is responsible for at least some good measure of it.
What about the Bush and Kerry campaigns right now? Do you think those campaigns are using the internet as effectively as they could?
No. I mean, one of the problems with politics is that money's everything. And so both of them figured out really fast, cool, this thing can do money, you know. And it didn't really, they didn't really until very recently, I don't think either of them have understood really how it can be used to actually engage people and get them to do things in their community the way the Dean campaign did. That'll be left for a candidate in 2006 and 2008, although there's a lot of congressional and Senate candidates that are out there using that very well. The interesting thing is I think the Bush campaign, like Republicans always do, have figured out that this is a new communications medium. And I don't think it was an accident that 60 Minutes got taken down in 19 minutes from the Free Republic site, which was a Republican site, that then leapt from there to the Drudge Report and to Fox. I mean, they've now, I think, figured out, cool, we can actually launch stuff off of this new medium, which doesn't have a whole lot of rules, and it can percolate up, and we can create, you know, the Swift Boat stuff. I mean, they've gotten very, very good in a way that the Kerry campaign doesn't, I don't think, has come to recognize how you can percolate a story off of the web and up into the mainstream media and devour or get someone like Kerry just rung in knots for a month, all off of something that started with very few dollars over the internet. So I think they're better the Bush campaign's doing a better job of that.
Thank you. This is the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley, and we're talking to Joe Trippi, political analyst and the author of The Revolution Will Not Be Televised, Democracy, the Internet, and the Overthrow of Everything. So, Joe, one of the questions is, should corporations be worried about this?
Yeah. I mean, you know, for anybody to believe they're immune, for the political parties to believe they're immune, for any industry to look at what happened in the recording industry and say, oh, that'll never happen to us. I mean, we're the movie industry or we're the car industry, is begging for disaster. And let me give you one thing. There's a rule. The SEC has rules about how you can put opposing slates for shareholders to take on a board of directors of a company. The rule was 35. You needed 35% of shareholders to do that. They're actually going to lower that. They're only negotiating this, but it could end up being 15-20%. Well, in the past, corporations never had this happen because how is anybody in this room going to convince 20 or even figure out how to reach 20 or 30% of shareholders to say, hey, we really need to change the leadership of the company that we're invested in? Well, until this year and the internet, the companies didn't have a whole lot to worry about. Now they do. And you're already seeing this in the Roy Disney-Eisner proxy fight. There was a Wall Street Journal article in which Roy Disney is talking to a guy in his pajamas. And the reason he's talking to a guy in his pajamas is the guy runs a website that's visited by 1.5 million Disney fanatics and shareholders every day. And Roy Disney understands that if he can get that community to start rallying on the internet, it's going to help him bring Eisner down. And Disney, I mean the actual corporation, had no clue that the internet was actively out there as part of the removing Eisner. So you're again seeing baby steps, just as Dean was sort of the initial thrust of this in politics. I think you're seeing the initial thrust into corporate governance, in Americans' ability to hold corporations accountable. I think Walmart is a likely target of real problems if they don't. And I'll give you one other. This is my favorite one, Best Buy. Best Buy has spent years trying to fend off Circuit City and Walmart, the big other neighborhood boxes in the neighborhood. And they stayed number one. And then last year, about 2 months ago, they woke up one day, and they're not number one anymore. And it's not Circuit City or Walmart. It's eBay. eBay in 2002 sold $0 of electronics to consumers. 2003 sells $2 billion of direct. Now, why is that? eBay's not an auction site. eBay is a community of 114 million people. And if they decide tomorrow that they're going to go after cameras, all of a sudden, camera companies are in trouble. You know, the photo stores are in trouble. So, yeah, this thing is going to wreak havoc on any unsuspecting company that doesn't understand what's really, or any institution. But it's also, we have real power now to I think get the kind of reform we want if we persevere and start using the tool.
Joe, we have a bunch of questions about, I guess it's truth on the internet. How do we sort out what's true? How do we test the veracity of different sites? How do we make informed opinions based on the range of information that's available on the internet?
Well, the first thing is we've always had this problem. From the beginning of the Republic, we've had the problem of misinformation, and particularly in politics. John Adams and Jefferson, think about this from a consulting point of view. How do you go negative on the guy who drafted the Declaration of Independence? they couldn't figure out how to do that, so they basically did two things. They basically used the same attack that the Republicans are using on Kerry right now. They said he was too French, that Jefferson was too French. And when that didn't really work, they basically got guys on horses who ran around the original states screaming at the top of their lungs, "Jefferson's dead." You know, and if you hadn't seen Jefferson in Delaware for a while, and now you got the problem. How do you disprove a negative? We put guys on horses screaming, "No, he's alive! He's alive!" We can't use a picture of him with the New York Times with today's date saying he's alive or any of that stuff. So we've had this kind of problem of misinformation from when horses were used to get the movie information around. I think the one thing about the net is it's very self-correcting and it's very fast. So most of these blogs that exist don't exist very long if they're lying, because we're all experts. We all figure this out. And they get called on it within minutes if they make a mistake. And they either have to correct themselves immediately or take thousands and thousands of comments telling them they've got it wrong. And if they keep doing it, their readership goes down. So you have the top four blogs in the country right now have a combined readership larger than the New York Times. We, in the top, whether it's a corporation or a political institution, has no problem returning the call of the New York Times reporter or reading the New York Times every day to see what the hell the New York Times is saying about their company or their issue. I don't think most of the top-down corporations, institutions in the country even bother to read those top four blocks. If something is being misspoken about you on there, on your corporation or what you're trying to do, you got to address it. I mean, it's a new medium that you have, and you have the ability, because you can go right back on that same blog and say you're wrong and actually engage him in a debate, the writer in a debate about it, till he gives and cries uncle, or the blog goes out of existence. In a lot of ways, it's more democratic and more correcting than the standard newspaper that has to wait to the next day and put one of these little corner one-inch things saying we were wrong yesterday, spelled Joe Trippi's name wrong or whatever. You know, he's not dead, he's alive, you know, that kind of, you know, thing. So I think it's a problem, but I also think it's in a lot of ways more self-correcting than our other media.
Do you have a blog, and what are some of the blogs and websites you check out regularly?
I have a blog, joetrippi.com. My favorites are atrios.com, thedailycause.com, Instapundit, who's more conservative and actually, I think, sort of quarrels with himself about whether he's a Bush supporter or not. His insta-wife is. You can get a flavor. The place to go if you're really interested in this is go to technorati.com, which will give you a whole list of the top 100 blogs on the internet, the top conservative blogs, the top liberal blogs, the top middle-of-the-road blogs, in a very non-biased, here's the info. If you're interested in these themes, go, here's the top ones that you should read. And I think it's a good place if you're just beginning to take a look at it to get a grasp of what it really may mean and how you might want to take part. And the thing is, there's 4 million blogs on the internet now. I think when John McCain was running for president, there were maybe 10 or 15. They were just in their infancy. That's another one of the things that's happened. It's just how fast the net matures and changes. Means that by 2008, you guys are going to be looking at me and going like, Trippy was so yesterday, and what that Dean campaign came up with was so primitive. Look at all these great social networking tools we have, and look at the reform we're building together. But that's part of the journey. That'll be fun.
That was
technorati.com.
technorati.com. Okay. Well, we have a question about the Dean campaign. You're probably not surprised to know. Looking back, what would you have done differently in the Dean campaign, and why do you think Dean didn't win?
Oh, man. The Dean campaign, the only way I can explain this to people was we were a Little League baseball team that was supposed to go to Fenway Park and buy nosebleed tickets, sit on the upper deck, make a hell of a lot of noise, and learn from the pros how to do on the field how to do politics. Excuse me. And the reason that's the case is the governor had never run for anything before. Governor Snelling died in office. The lieutenant governor, Dean, became governor. And then he never had a race. He really did get health care for those kids. He really did lower the income tax twice and balance the budget. And they'd run Bozo the Clown against him. So as long as he didn't honk Bozo's nose in the middle of the debate, he won. And he thought this was a tough race. So what really happened here was Howard Dean's first contested race of his life, was for president of the United States of America. When you think of that, just on its own, tells you how tough the odds were. And I had 22-year-old kids running into my office saying, put me in, coach, because no pros would come. Not a single pro would come. Put me in, coach. And I'd go, have you ever played shortstop before? And the kid would go, no, but I've got a glove. Okay, just stand between second and third base and just stop the ball. Okay, just do your best to stop the ball. So this group of kids, myself, I'm not your first pick to run a presidential campaign. Yes, I've been in presidential campaigns before, but the last campaign I had managed, because I basically chilled out of politics, the last campaign I had managed was for city attorney of Los Angeles in 1985. Not exactly your picture-perfect resume to run a 50-state national campaign. So you have all that going on, and we're ingenious. These kids are ingenious. They're doing things. They're building a campaign that no one's ever built before. But we kind of lacked that just the old-style political experience that you do need to fend off the attacks, to not make rookie mistakes, like saying, I have a hole in my resume. I don't understand foreign policy and defense. You know, in New Hampshire, or to the senior in Iowa, sit down, it's my turn to talk. I mean, these are rookie mistakes that a guy running for Congress in his first time would make and would learn and never do again. And Howard was learning those in his first fight. And so, first, we're an insurgent, the party establishment, all the rules are designed to kill insurgents. So we got that against us. We've got this. I mean, actually, the fact that Howard Dean went as far as he did, that the campaign went as far as it is, I think speaks more to the innate talent that he had and his ability to communicate with people and just how ingenious this group of 22, 23, 24-year-old kids were. The miracle wasn't that the Boston Red Sox came from behind and beat us in the bottom of the ninth. It was how the hell did we get on the field, take a lead and hold it to the top of the ninth. And, yeah, did we have something to do with blowing it in the bottom? Sure we did, but the miracle was how were we out there? How did we do this? How did we get 650,000 Americans to actually get involved in politics in a meaningful way that people hadn't seen in years. And in a lot of ways, that probably happened because there weren't any pros. I mean, you know, had we had pros, we probably would have run a totally different, more, I mean, who knows? But it was part of the magic of the campaign, but it was also part of the downfall of the campaign. That inexperience, that willing to risk it all. Our inside the campaign, our motto was, running for president is like jumping out of a 16-story building and believing in all your heart the American people will catch you before you hit the cement. We kept that a secret because we knew the press would think, oh my God, they're absolutely insane. They're jumping. But I mean, that was sort of the spirit of the campaign. I really honestly believe that if some leader who has actually had the nomination ran that way, I mean, really trusting the American people to catch him, and for the American people actually feel that was going on, would just be so energizing to this country and really move us forward in a great way. We just didn't get there.
Probably the other big internet success in the last year or two has been MoveOn.org. Could you talk about their success, how it parallels the Dean campaign?
Well, they're pioneers that were out there, deserve a lot of the credit that often the Dean campaign gets for changing things. I mean, they were they offered every single presidential campaign to come on the Democratic side to come in, and we'll sit there for 2 weeks and tell you everything we know. And every other campaign said, who are you? Get lost. And the Dean campaign, of course, we didn't have any pros, so we said, sounds good to us. And they came in and we learned, it was interesting because we had intellectual debates with them. They did not believe in blogs. They thought blogs were a waste of time. It was really interesting because we learned a lot from them, but they learned a lot from us. They're now big believers in blogs and things, but the synergy of Move On and what they had started that gave us some insight in the kind of tools we wanted to build, like Get Local tools so people could do things locally. They had been doing things like that for candlelight vigils that they held. And so we really literally ripped off their tools. I mean, we programmed them ourselves, but we studied them and, you know, and thank God they weren't Microsoft and didn't sue us for doing that. But, I mean, stealing their code. But they really had a big impact, are having a huge impact. I think the biggest thing that the internet did this year, aside from the Dean campaign, is there's absolutely no way John Kerry would be competitive at all. I mean, he's raised $300 million to George Bush's $243. No one. I mean, the Democrats were supposed to be all stop at $45 million. That difference comes from, literally, Kerry's got 1.7 million people have contributed an average of $108. And that's where that whole, the one thing I've never figured out is why they haven't juxtaposed that versus Bush's Pioneers and Rangers. I mean, really used that as a powerful descriptive difference between their campaign and the Halliburton and the oil companies running our energy policy and the but they haven't. But the fact is they would not be competitive. I think we wouldn't have cared who he picked for VP because he'd be being outspent $250 million to zip. Going down the stretch here. So it's pretty phenomenal. Just the evening of the playing field. It's the first Democrat I can think of since maybe John F. Kennedy, when that was, when you could write real big checks to yourself, and Joe Kennedy wrote a lot. But I think the first time that I think the Democrats actually are outspending the Republicans, that's not the case. Usually it's the other way around big time.
We have a series of questions on, I guess, suppressing this revolution. So one is there any danger that the internet might be regulated to the extent that it would no longer be accessible and as effective as a tool of mass communication?
Yeah. I mean, there's all kinds of regulation, potential regulation, and other technologies that are, like anything, technology can be used for really good stuff, and it can be used to stop things or to change how we would use it. You have not just the net, but you have Walmart basically demanding that every one of the companies that sends products into a store has to use an RFID tag chip. The chip will monitor that product in built into the product packaging, and everywhere that product goes, from the warehouse to the store to your house into the medicine cabinet, they'll know where it is. I mean, this is happening. What is they want the chip to get down to $0.08 a pop right now to get this chip into the product. Walmart's demanding that they get it down to $0.05 a chip, and once it's done, it's into every product that's in the store. So you're now, this could be a really good thing. Your refrigerator can tell you you're out of milk. Okay, I understand that. It could also be, you don't have to be a conspiracy theorist to figure out what these, with all these chips all over the place, they will know everything about you and where you are, and how's our private, who's going to guard our privacy? How are we going to use that technology for good stuff, but at the same time make sure our privacy is protected, or do we need to stop it? And this same kind of thing is happening on the internet. You've got to change the way the internet works to actually secure it against cyber attack and cyber terrorism. Just like with the Patriot Act, there are pluses and minuses to that, and we have to get, the American people need to be engaged and understand what's coming, and not just take this technology that's coming down the pike without questioning it.
Joe, the so-called 527 organizations have been related to the internet revolution you're talking about, and John McCain and George Bush have talked about reforming or eliminating these. Do you think Congress will try to limit these kinds of campaign contributions, and what repercussions will that have on the revolution you're discussing?
Every time someone tries to do campaign finance reform, the lawyers on both sides find some way to drive a Mack truck through it. I believe Feingold and McCain believed in their hearts that, I mean, these are, we're talking about good people try to fix this system, and it doesn't work. My own view is they'll monkey with it. They may abolish 527s. There'll be some other loophole that we'll find. And I think in the end, the big story of 2003 is that no one's going to change the system for you. You have to do it. And that we are campaign finance reform. If you ever see the day when 5 million Americans give $100 to a reform cause or to a candidate, 5 million Americans giving $100 is $500 million. It's only $100 for you to go buy your democracy back from the lobbyists in the system that stops us from getting health care, because the lobbyists, it's not about whether the health care plan's good or not. Had lots of them. They all get killed by the special interests of the lobbyists. So my own view is the net is our shot at creating real reform, because you have to, if you can get 3, 4, 5 million Americans engaged and making a small investment in buying the system back, then we can go change it. But otherwise, it'll be loophole after loophole. And I've seen the movie too many times. I guess the one thing I would do is let candidates take all the money they want, and the day they take it, they have to report that they took it. So if a guy wanted to take $2 million from Exxon, he could. But everybody would know that he took $2 million from Exxon, because they're taking it anyway. They're just shipping it into swift boat captains or somebody else. Mm-hmm. I mean, who don't have the... No, and on the same thing on the Democratic side, neither party is pure on this subject, so I'm not trying to say that. I'm just saying that the loopholes are there. Both parties figured out how to drive trucks through them, and it's not good for our democracy.
And the internet does change the sunshine. It changes the disclosure, because we all have more instant access.
Right.
And more people telling us about it. So we've talked about 527s and other ways the internet revolution might be suppressed. The third question relating to that is really about the co-optation of the internet revolution. And here's the question. Last night after the vice presidential debate, NBC News included a segment with two bloggers, Wong Ked and somebody else. So yes, the revolution might not be televised, but like all dominant media, the networks might co-opt it, or Walmart might co-opt it. So talk about co-optation.
I think it's really unlikely for the net to be co-opted. And the reason is, it's one of the reasons the Republicans are actually pretty bad at using the internet tools. Any entity that has a top-down structure, a top-down discipline to it, is anathema to the net and to what it means. So one of the great things that we had realized in the Dean campaign is you have to give up some control. And if you don't give up control, you cannot create what we created. So most corporations, most of the big media guys, most of the political institutions in the country are the last people on the planet, and particularly Republicans are much more command and control than Democrats are. That's why they're so good at message discipline than Democrats are. So, I mean, it works for them. They're not going to change what works for them. They may, over time, like with direct mail and other little things that us Democrats or progressives have come up with, that they realize, oh, that works, and then they learn how to give up control. But my own view is progressives, reformers, Democrats have our cultural way that we organize things or that we think is much more akin to a bottom-up, grassroots building mechanism than the corporations or the big guys. I think what they're doing is they're actually continue to create the net. The best example I can give is the war. When all the networks went embed and had their big shock and awe, named their programming off of pro-war slogans, it actually drove more people to the net to read blog reports because they were getting this empty fluff stuff from the networks. And so every time the networks do that, they're actually creating a bigger blogosphere and more people reading it. And now they're trying to figure out how do you get in front of that? I mean, they're losing viewers. Print media is losing readers. The blogosphere and the internet's gaining exponentially in viewers and readers. How do they change that? And their bigger problem is things like Craigslist. I don't know how many of you have heard of this, but Craigslist is demolishing print newspapers. It's wiping out their classified ad sections. And so the news industry is getting sort of just devoured with it, particularly in the last couple of years, devoured on both the business side and the scoop side by the internet. And I think, yeah, they're going to try some desperate attempt, put more bloggers on the air. Gannett, the USA Today, does a thing every Friday, I think, where it's like what's happening on the blogs on their opinion page. They have a right-wing blogger and a left-wing blogger who go at each other. And so they'll try to figure out how to grab it and include it, but I don't think they're going to be able to stop it.
The next question is a little partisan. What do you recommend as a strategy to replace the current governor of California?
Well, he in a lot of ways represents what's happened in this bottom-up stuff. I mean, in a lot of ways he was. There were a lot of people on the net leading the charge for him, and you saw this with Ventura in Minnesota. This was more partisan because Arnold ran as a Republican, but I actually take him as more of a sign of how this is all going to continue to go. I mean, that we're going to see more Jesse Venturas, more Arnolds, and frankly, I believe that's where we're going nationally as well. I think it's very likely that if the two parties, in a lot of ways, like what happened in California, there was sort of almost a denial thing about how bad things had gotten, and not adjusting to it fast enough. And so suddenly there's this urge just to change for change's sake, and he seems cool, so let's do it, because it can't get any worse than it is. I think that same thing is happening nationally when you look at George Bush and 631 Pioneers and Rangers funneling, and pulling together $243 million. Here's the really crazy part. Guess which party raises more money from individuals who give $100? The Republicans. And that goes all the way from $1,000, Republicans, $100,000 and below, Republicans. The only category the Democratic Party leads in versus the Republican Party is contributions of $1 million and above. So you have these two parties that have become addicted, I mean literally addicted, to big mega donations. The Dean campaign, and I think Kerry now with the internet, has changed that in the Democratic Party. But you can't have two parties addicted to that kind of money without the same thing happening nationwide at some point. A guy coming out of the woodwork who actually says they both are rotten to the core, and I'm not going to take anything over $100. Jerry Brown tried this in the 1992 race, and we're going to change you, the American people, are going to change the system if you dare. And I think a third party will emerge, because in the past they had nowhere to go. Reformers had nowhere to go. Now, where are you going to get $200 million? You're not going to get it. You know, in the past, where could you do that? Where are you going to get the money to compete? Where are you going to get the volunteers? Just go to the net. It's only going to take a couple million people, give $100, and you got $200 million. And there's 300 million of us. And I think there's 2 million Americans who would borrow $100 to change the system. So, I mean, I think that the impetus is there. If the two parties, I think there's plenty of time for the Democratic Party to recognize that they can change themselves from within and really be that new, creative, positive force for the country. That's what we've always been. We just got to get back to our roots to do that. And I think we lost our way to a large extent during the 90s when we just didn't realize what the change that was happening. And we kind of got forced into doing that to be competitive. And what happened was they were outselling their souls for big bucks from the corporations. We couldn't raise enough dollars from small folks, so we were tired of getting beat up and losing, so we threw in the towel and started raising money from big money, because that was the only way we could stay competitive, and we'd take it from whoever would give it to us. And now the party hopefully has woke up and said, wait a minute, we can go back to our roots, we can do this with average Americans and actually represent working people again and get them health care and fight this differently. And if we do that, I think the Democratic Party will survive. If both these parties keep doing it the way they're doing it, then I would predict some other third force, like an Arnold, actually gets created because of two parties that don't get it.
So it's really up to the California Democratic Party to figure out another way.
Yeah.
Well, the next question is related to that. And it's thanks to the most recent redistricting scheme arranged and approved by the California State Legislature. There are no competitive congressional districts in the state, and other states are going the same way, as you know. Why should people vote if their vote's been neutralized in this way?
Well, let me tell you the real... I mean, it's not just that. It's, first of all, the Democrats did this to the Republicans for like 40 or 50 years. Willie Brown... The difference is that with technology and stuff now, we can really get really, really, really good at drawing the line. So it's kind of like one of these things where we were doing it, we just weren't as good at it because we didn't have the technology we have today. And I'm talking about just targeting and stuff. The real problem is going to be this move on the Electoral College. What's going on here is we're literally getting close to a point where my guess is every single election, it will be possible for the Democrats to win the popular vote and lose the electoral vote. Because what's happened is it's an artifact of the Constitution, the way the Electoral College works. States like California, huge populations, only get two electoral votes for their senators, just like Idaho. This was an artifact that our founders couldn't possibly, see way into the future what a mistake it could be. And so what's going to happen here, let's say that starts happening. I mean, where a guy like John Kerry can win by 2 million votes and still lose the Electoral College because of Idaho and Wyoming and Montana. Who's going to want to change it? Well, the Republicans are not going to want to change that. and they've got the state houses and everything. So, in other words, you're not going to, you could literally, we could literally devolve into a permanent, like we did when the Democrats are in charge, but this time, with demographics and everything, it changes so much, and the move is so for them that we can't ever get control back, even though Democrats would have a majority of votes. It's going to be a really interesting time.
Well, this is the last question, Joe. It's a tough one, so take time and think about your answer. And the question is, what was the name of your book again, and and where can we buy it?
The book is called The Revolution Will Not Be Televised, Democracy, the Internet, and the Overthrow of Everything. You can get it at Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com, and you can most of your local bookstores, particularly independent bookstores, will carry it or order it for you and get it into your hands. And I think there's some here that I'll sign.
Thank you, Joe.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I hope you all enjoyed today's Voices of Reform program presented by the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. Again, we would like to thank Joe Trippi, political analyst and author of The Revolution Will Not Be Televised, Democracy, the Internet, and the Overthrow of Everything. Dr. Terry Christensen, political science professor at San Jose State University, the San Jose Downtown Association, the James Irvine Foundation, to our audience here in San Jose, and those of you joining us on the radio. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club, Silicon Valley, part of the nation's largest and oldest public affairs forum, is adjourned.
Thank you.
Well, I got good news. I was in Vancouver.